Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The show is about to begin.
Welcome to the podcast, Conscience That Made Us. Interviews and stories, tales from the bus. We love taking you back to when it all went down. The greatest live shows and that cheering crowd sound. It's Concerts, Concerts That Made Us, ConcertsThatMadeUs.com.
What's happening? I'm Jeff.
And I'm Ian.
From American Jet Set, and you're listening to Concerts That Made Us.
Decades of decadence, but I still feel the demon locked away in my evil twin. I buried all the bones, my blackest days behind me. My beast is waking up again. It's feeding all my energy. Revenge has made us more than friends. My heart is crumbling like the embers of our enemies. My love, it's time to rest again.
Jeff, you're very welcome to Concerts That Made Us.
Hey, thanks for having us, man.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's great to have you now. I'm looking forward to diving into your music over the next bit. So, American Jet Set recently released Firestarter. One hell of a song. Take us a bit deeper into it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, we we were sort of in between records. Like we're actually recording our next record now, and we were in between records, and we had been writing and writing and writing. And I think we had a handful of things that we wanted to put out as an EP. And then we ended up deciding to go into the studio, throw them together, and then release them as singles one by one as all of the holidays were hitting. First, it was Halloween, then it was Thanksgiving, then Christmas. So everything kind of hit and it worked out really well. The Firestarter was by far like the fan favorite, the band favorite. Obviously dips into old Motley Crue and a whole bunch of other stuff that we really love and just felt like the right thing to go into that period with.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Motley Crue because I'm not sure if the camera can pick it up.
There it is. Nice.
And when it comes to making new music, then what does the process look like for you guys?
I mean, I think it happens in a couple of ways. Like, you know, a couple of records ago, we had before COVID, the band was in a room all the time together. And, you know, we were going in and with, you know, our bass player likes to say, you know, I'd go to the bathroom and then I'd come back and we'd have two new songs, you know? So that was a really fun way of doing it. And we still do it that way. But then there's also a guy, one of us, me, guitar player, whatever, will go and kind of cook up a demo or two and come in with those. And sometimes I come in with whole songs that I'm just like, hey, what does everybody think of this? And then they either give me a yay or nay, and then we move forward with two. So I think it just works in any number of ways for us right now. I think if COVID had never happened, we'd probably be still doing everything in the same room, the same way we were at the time. But thankfully, we were able to explore a couple of different avenues.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that you recorded a lot of songs, released them as singles. What do you think of the whole, you know, the way that's supposed to be the better way of doing it now compared to releasing an album? What do you think of that whole thing?
Well, if I could say something about this, singles are great. You know, I've worked for labels where I've had my own record label and things, and it's great to go and release a single, put it out there. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, people are just waiting for the next single. I kind of compare it to TV shows that come out on streaming. Sometimes, you know, they'll drop the whole season and you end up watching it in 2 days and then you can't wait for the next. And then, you know, when you get it where they release it once a week or once every once in a while, you know, you get frustrated with that. So that's kind of what happens, I think. You know, when you put out a whole album at once, like maybe not all the songs get the attention that they deserve. And, you know, after, you know, 6-9 months, people are waiting for the next record. But if you can space it out with singles, it can work. I mean, there's many different ways you can do it, but we like to sell merchandise live, and we still do CDs and vinyl, even cassettes. And, you know, for that stuff, I mean, you can't, you know, I think that our fans in particular really like to have physical merch. So releasing singles doesn't do them a whole lot of good as far as collecting things. So this past Christmas, we put out an EP that was all the singles that were never attached to an album and a Christmas song. And we put it all on one CD so people could, you know, get that physical something that they need. But I mean, we've been doing this for a while where we'll put out a record, then maybe an EP, then a single or two, and then we'll do another record. So I don't know. I mean, it all pretty much works for us, but we like to do it all. I don't think we're going to go in the direction where we only put out singles or only put out albums. I don't know. What do you think, Ian? That's
just real quick on that. You know, I think all the guys in our band, at least, we are all children of the 80s. So there's something to be said, from my point of view, for a record, something that actually is sequenced for a reason and is an experience by itself. And so while we record music for, you know, hoping that people will like it, in large part, we're just doing it for ourselves. And in that regard, I love listening to records. And so the singles are fun for me, but you know, we always love to have a theme. You know, I hate sounding like the concept record guy. We're not, you know, King Diamond or anything, obviously, but all of the records are themed, and there's something about that where you can kind of tie that theme throughout the songwriting. There's something to be said for that.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, around the time of the release, you went on a coast-to-coast run supporting Jack Russell's Great White and Faster Pussycat as well. What was that like?
I mean, you know, we started this band back in 2019, 2018, something like that. And the whole idea of this band wasn't to do wasn't to even accomplish half as much as we have. It was started as a bucket list band. Like, we started this band and started writing down bands we wanted to play with, you know, if we had our way. And so I think we crossed off almost every band the first year that we were together. And then we started adding new bands to the list. And so Jack Russell, Faster Pussycat, LA Guns, Tom Kiefer, all the bands we've played with have been just, it's been amazing. So to say that run was amazing, all of it's been amazing, because it's all been sort of like, you know, dream territory, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask, what do you learn when you're playing on that level with those guys?
Well, there's a couple of things. I'll bring up one part of it is that, you know, one of my favorite things to do is to kind of cater our show and cater our set list to the folks that we think are going to be there. So it's fun to go, oh man, we're going to play to Faster Pussycat's crowd in LA, you know, on, you know, the day before New Year's Eve. And so we kind of plan on it that way, because, you know, we know we do have our own following that come to the shows, and that's great. But we know that a majority of the people are going to be fans of that band that we're playing with. So we really try to do the best we can on, you know, picking the exact songs we're going to play and how we're going to address them, because, you know, we're playing for them. They're not, you know, it's pretty interesting. But it's been pretty fantastic the whole way. I mean, all these crowds have accepted us like, well better received than I thought it could happen. It's been great every single time. And it's been everything from, you know, even like we played with Mike Tramp from White Lion, and it was him and a guitar and another guy and a guitar and a drum machine. Like, that was their show. We didn't know what that was going to be like. So we were like, instead of catering to that crowd, we're like, we want to play, we're playing to White Lion fans tonight, and we're going to write our set list that way. We're going to play that way. And it ended up that particular night great, because I don't think their fans were expecting it to be, you know, such a, you know, I don't know, augmented, you know, set. So they got their loud rock, they got their solos, they got all the stuff that they love White Lion for. They got it all, and they didn't get it from White Lion. You know what I mean? So it was one incident that was pretty cool.
Also, you do learn, one thing I learned that night is sometimes you write a song that sounds way too much like an artist.
Well, like right before we go, I'm like, dude, can we play that song? Because they're going to do the, you know.
It might sound a little too much like Little Fighter.
And I can't move on without asking as well, the Whiskey A Go-Go, you played it on New Year's Eve with LA Guns. Mm-hmm. For me, over in Ireland, the Whiskey is like, I've said it before, it's like Mecca for rock music. What was it like for you guys?
Well, I think that was our ninth show there. I think
you're used to it, so
it's great. Well, we're used to it. Is hard. You never really get used to playing on that stage just because of what it is. I think that excitement builds up. Even I think like three right before the pandemic, Kiss played there in full makeup. Def Leppard played there a few years ago. Like, bands are that are not only established, but well into their Hall of Fame career, still go back and play there. So it's pretty wild. But, you know, we get to play out there a lot. It's my favorite part of being in the band is to get to go out there and play as much as we do. It's awesome.
You know, the first time I played there was before I was in this band. But the first I played there, I remember going up into the green room. And this was back before they rebuilt the green rooms there. And the first thing you see is Tommy Lee's giant signature on the wall. And there's just an experience about being in those green rooms, being on that stage and just being in that spot. Los Angeles has always been a second home to me. It's become a second home to the band. And I would say that it's by far Los Angeles in general, not just the Whiskey, but it's by far our favorite place to play outside of our hometown. And I think it, you know, on some level, we almost consider ourselves an LA band at this point, because I think we have probably more of our fan base sits on the West Coast than it does on the East Coast at this point.
And last year, 2023, we played at the Whiskey or played in LA more than we played, you know, on the East Coast where we're from. So, so it is our second home, or, I mean, maybe we live in our second home. I don't know. But as far as the band, I mean, it pretty much exists over there more than over here for sure. But I will say something outside of the Whiskey. being in a club like that, there's a handful of them in the U.S. You know, CBGB's is closed. There's certain places that were there, certain that remain. The whiskey is number one. But, you know, what Ian was saying, you're being in those dressing rooms and getting ready to walk on those stages that all those things happen in is pretty wonderful. Maybe 15 so years ago, I got to play at First Avenue in Minneapolis where Purple Rain was filmed. And the first thing I wanted to do was go back into that dressing room and look at that scene from that movie. It was so iconic. The thing is that at the whiskey, a lot of the things that you see in the movie and TV are, you know, recreations of it. I'm pretty sure wasn't that show, the Daisy and the Six.
Yeah.
Like they did some scenes there and.
No, they didn't. They rebuilt the entire venue. Shoot it.
Yeah, it's great. And same with it was in a Future Man that Seth Rogen show. But they did a lot of the whiskey there. It was like shot on the outside. So it's so famous for just being what it is outside of even, you know, anything else. It's crazy. It's wonderful to be on that stage.
I love it. I love it. And your upcoming LP, Devils and Angels, is dropping in May. What can you tell us?
This is a little bit of a left turn for us. You know, every record is a little bit different. And we were kind of going down this really heavy path. You know, obviously, if you listen to Firestarter, you're hearing probably, if you're listening for influences, you're probably hearing Too Fast for Love and some other things that are in there. This definitely veers back into more pop and glam stuff. I mean, I'd say that the record has a very, somewhere between the Poison, Cheap Trick side of the world. And because we wanted to really make a summer record, you know, we wanted people to put this on and not take it out of their car. You know, if this was on a cassette, and some of our records are on cassettes, if this was on a cassette, I just want this sitting in someone's car all summer long. And then I want them to sing our single, which is called 1987. I want them to sing that all summer. It's going to be, we're really looking forward to this one.
When he says we're veering in more of a heavy direction, in 2023, we put out Love Kills EP, which was dark. A lot of bondage themes, things like that. And then Hell's Out to Getcha, Firestarter. These were all dark, heavier things. And we were sitting in the dressing room at the whiskey and the green room. We're sitting back there and Ian looks at us all. He's like, you know what I'm going to go home and do after the holidays? I'm going to go home and write an entire album in major keys. and it's going to be a fun summer pop record, right? And we're all looking at him like, huh? And what do you know? We take a little time off at the holidays and then, you know, 2 weeks into January, he's like, here's the album. It's done. Here are all the demos. And dude, it's all like, you know, like poppy, major key, fun songs. I mean, it still gets heavy. It's still loud and crazy.
It sounds like us. I mean,
sounds like us, but it's definitely in a little bit of a direction, which is going to be great when we go to put together our set list for live shows this year, because we'll be doing the heavier, darker stuff and some of the, you know, stuff that you'll be able to jump up and down to and scream out, have a good time to chant along. There's a lot of like really like arena type anthems and choruses here. So.
Right. I have to ask, what sound are you most comfortable with? And since you kind of, you flip flop between dark and poppy and heavy rock.
I think that maybe, it's confusing to kind of hear it with how we've described it, but I don't think there's a differentiation in the sound at all. I think it's just because the band sounds identical to the way it's going to perform on this record versus the others. I think there was a leaning toward more darker themes, right? This record is it's a more of an anthem rock record, so it's a little poppier in terms of the keys, but I don't think there's a difference in sound. In fact, someone said, "Is this a progression?" Someone asked me in an interview if it was a progression. And I don't necessarily see any of these things as progressions. They're just different moods, or they're different parts of the same mood even. You know what I mean? So I think Robert Smith once said all of their records are 12 parts of the same mood, right? This is kind of like that, where I don't see the band as changing or doing anything different. There's parts of what we're doing here that we did on our first record. There's parts of what we did on our second record in this, you know, some, it's just really just a little bit of a turn in this direction for this album. That's it.
Right. I like it. And I suppose at this stage, you know, the podcast is called Concerts That Made Us. So I have to ask you some concert related questions. First off, as a concert goer, what concerts have made you?
I would say it was probably 1992, summer 1992. I saw Fishbone for the first time, and they'd always been a band I loved. But I'd never seen, I've never had a live experience like that. They were wild from beginning to end, switching instruments, playing two instruments at once the whole time. And the way they whipped the crowd into a frenzy was awesome. So that was 1992. Leading into that, I was going to a lot of, you know, like these metal concerts and hair metal concerts and all this in the late 80s. And you were getting more of that full arena effect. You know, Motley Crue, I saw Motley Crue and Poison and David Lee Roth and all the Van Halen, all the bands that you would think that you would see at that time. And seeing that and loving it, and then a few years later, getting to see it with, you know, maybe 2,000-3,000 people and the whole crowd moving the whole time. I think that changed kind of how I want to perform. That was a big change for me when I went and saw that experience.
Right. Sounds like a hell of a concert.
Oh, it was Primus was opening for Fishbone. I mean, how 1992 can you get, right?
Yeah.
It was a wild night, definitely.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, probably a combination of things, but when I was a kid, I lived with musicians in my house. My mom dated musicians. We had roommates that were musicians. And one of the bands that she used to hang around with and know pretty well was a band called Kix. If you know of Kix at all, they used to be called The Shoes back when I was 9 years old. And so she would drag me around to bars, which apparently was okay at the time in the 70s. Right. And we'd go see them. And I sort of watched that happen up until I was in my late teens. And was in love with just watching bands perform, especially because that band's so dynamic live. And then after that, in 1984, I think my very first concert was actually seeing Van Halen in 1984 at in the Beltway?
Capitol Center.
Yeah. And I think you can still find that show online, funny enough. But
Autograph opening, right?
Yeah, Autograph. And that changed my life. That was amazing. That changed everything. And then I would say that since playing in this band, the one show that like I still can't even get over was the Tom Kiefer opening for Tom Kiefer, because I loved Cinderella and I loved Tom Kiefer. And there was definitely an influence from for sure. But that night, I just had no idea what a freaking rock star Tom Kiefer was, to watch him just absolutely command that stage. Like, I've never seen anybody do that before. And I had no idea that that was what he did, how he came across. He was unbelievable.
Right. Oh my God. And a bit of a fun one now. Is there a gig that you guys have attended that your fans would be surprised by?
I mean, Hall & Oates, I see Hall & Oates whenever they come around. That's my jam.
I mean, I remember being 14 and going and getting drunk at Mike and the Mechanics, of all things. And then, I'm a huge Smiths fan. I'm a huge Morrissey fan. So, I mean, the number of times I've seen any band on that side of the fence probably would surprise most of the people that listen to what we do.
Well, you went, what was it, like last summer, the summer before, didn't you see a certain 90s band at Merriweather Post? That I was surprised at.
Oh, we saw the Goo Goo Dolls.
Yeah.
Yeah. But is that a surprise? I don't know.
I would think it'd be a surprise.
Well, my
wife, I know how you write songs.
My wife and I walked down the aisle to one of their songs. So that was the impetus for the whole thing. So they were awesome.
I mean, for me, Hall & Oates, that would be the one that I think people would just be kind of surprised.
Yeah. And, you know, the moment we're all waiting for any listeners that haven't been lucky enough to catch one of your shows, what can we expect? Lay it all out for us.
Well, we back on the road again in late April. We're going to be opening for the 69 Eyes on, I think, April 11th. And then if Jeff has it up, maybe he can tell you the rest of it. But I know that we're playing M3, which is the show that happens before M3. And that is on a Thursday in May, I mean, May 3rd. Am I right on that, Jeff?
Right.
If you have the rest, that would be great.
I was just saying that off the top of my head, but I think it's a week later, May 10th, we're playing with Trickster outside of Baltimore. And then in the first weekend in June, we're going to be back at the Whiskey with, who's that with, Pretty Boy Floyd?
And Demalls.
and Demoz, Pretty Boy Floyd and Demoz. What I would say to expect, if you're going to come out and see us at the Whiskey or maybe one of the other shows, is that typically we're playing with a national touring act. Usually we're in front of them, right? So it's a little smaller of a space right there. But I think by like the second song in, they'll forget that we're set up, you know, we're closer to them. And they'll forget that the drums are set up in front of another drum. And I think that they'll be surprised, because even when a good amount of our fans come out to see us, there's still a majority is there to see, you know, the headlining act. And be prepared to be surprised. I think you're going to be surprised at how much you like an opening band.
We put a lot of energy into the show, and we convert a lot of fans for sure every single time we play.
Right, right. You sound like one of them bands that the main act is going to be like, we're not having them. They love us. They love them more than they love us.
It may have happened a couple times.
Yeah, I'm not saying anything.
How do you make the leap then from, you know, the opening band, the support band, to where the national guys are?
I mean, I obviously it would be sales and support in the live arena. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it that is the biggest jump there is. There's no bigger jump than being an opening band to being a headliner band, because you have to take that step back and you go, okay, well, that's great. Well, we can headline this next thing, but it's still the same amount of fans at that point, right? Without the sales or without more exposure, it's still the same size. So, you know, would I rather play to, you know, 75 of our fans and 300 of someone else's fans at the Whiskey? Or would I rather play to 75 of our own fans in a corner bar with the dartboard behind me? You know, I like playing to the bigger crowds, and it happens to work for us. I think we're really selective on the shows that we're on, and I think that we don't put ourselves in a place where we're put in front of a bunch of people who at the end probably wouldn't dig our style of music.
Well, and the other thing too is, you know, it all comes down to presentation. Our band presents well in large theater environments because the kind of music we do, what we need out of the audio, what we need out of the lights, what we need in terms of the background. So it's better for us to present ourselves in front of another band because they're going to be playing a larger theater, right? And the other thing that we are to these bigger bands is we're a great package, because when these promoters are putting together opening shows, they're selecting people that they can sell that show better to. And people's minds change when they know that we're on the bill. That happens all the time. We play a local place called Tally Ho. And that is a lot of times the deciding line for folks getting tickets.
Right, right. And I love asking this question now. Out of all the gigs you guys have played, is there one that's maybe the highlight that stands above the rest that just went perfectly?
Well, I think Ian mentioned his.
Yeah.
when we opened for Tom Kiefer.
Is it the same for you?
Mine was, there's been a lot, but one of my, I mean, playing, we play with Living Color. And that was cool with me. I don't like them more than the other bands we play with, but it was just really, really cool. And I got to spend a lot of time with drummer Will Calhoun, who was an idol of mine. So that was really cool. But I mean, playing with Steven Adler at the Whiskey, I mean, that show was sold out. It was wild. And probably this past, the night before the LA Gun Show, we played at this past year, we played at the Whiskey with Faster Pussycat and Foxy Rocks. Get that mixed up. And that was a fantastic show. I mean, that was packed wall to wall. Everybody was partying their faces off. I mean, that night I really felt like it was 1989. It just felt like that in the building. You know, so that would probably be some of my favorites, I think, that we played. I loved playing the Mike Tramp thing at M3. That was an M3 VIP party specifically for people who had VIP passes to the festival. So you knew that this was the crowd who really loves this kind of music, because if they're spending several thousand dollars on a ticket to a show, and then this is their exclusive chance to come in and see Mike Tramp and us. And I think we blew the roof off. So that was really a big highlight for me.
Yeah, well, Tom Kiefer show was definitely like a highlight. I'd still say that our shows with either Steven Piercy or Steven Adler at the Whiskey were by far my most like if I was going to tell this to somebody in, you know, 20 or 30 years to my kids, I'd tell them about those shows, because the show we did with Stephen Piercy there was like the most 80s show of all 80s shows, because I mean, there was so much stuff going on around the event. Like the whole green room was filled with strippers. There was like a threesome going on right next to the merch booth. I mean, it was insane. It was such an 80s environment. It was crazy.
I picked the right show to bring my kid to. I'm walking through the backstage going, oh, dude, it ain't like this. And he's like, wait. And then he started asking me the ages of the guys that were in that band. And he was like, they're still doing that? I'm like, he is. He is. Some of the other bands, you know, they roll in separate vehicles. You don't even really see them together, and they get dropped off from their vehicles and stuff in front. And then you got guys like Stephen Piercy, where him and his band party like it's fucking, you know, 1984, and that they can handle it. And maybe they can. I don't know. I didn't see him the next day. I don't know how that went down, but boy, was it a fucking party, man. That was something else,
man. Sounds like the ultimate gig. And yeah. If we flip that around, then is there a gig from your whole career now that you would say was the worst? So everything went wrong. Oh, and how did you overcome it?
Whole career or just in this band?
I was timing out. I mean, with this band, I mean, you go, okay, bad gig of what couple things, right? We had a gig where we played a festival. It was one of those festivals where the space of where the concert was didn't match how many people that were going to be there. That being said, they put it on like a horse track where the capacity is probably like, I don't know what, like 5,000, 6,000, but they book bands big enough to draw maybe 500. You take 500 people and you spread them out over a space that fits 6,000. It looks like there's three people there. And we played one of those. And there was great, you know, other great bands on it, would have sold out a nightclub. But it was just a smattering. And, we were on, probably mid afternoon, 2-3 ish in the afternoon, hot as fuck. It was August here in Frederick, Maryland. And, we're playing this big outdoor stage, and, our bass player just starts dancing around like crazy while he's playing. He's spinning around. He starts dancing, freaking out. The rest of us are up there trying to count the people. Like I said, a lot more than it looked like, but, it ends up that, there was a beehive in the monitor in front of him. And when he started playing, it shook and the whole beehive opened up and he was being swarmed by bees.
Oh my God.
But we were so far apart on stage, 'cause it was this giant freaking stage, that we found out, I mean, he survived and he played it off well, but now we look back on it and go, that's what he was doing. That was kind of a disaster, and he played right through it.
Well, in this band, I think that that show actually was pretty fun to me, but
it was a great show. Just saying, yeah, those are the, you know,
yeah, but I'd say that in this band, we played some just dumpy place in Pennsylvania and like some roadhouse type place. And there's no smoking in bars here in the States, except in this bar, they just decided we're just going to have a smoking, a rule that anybody can smoke all night long if they want. Whole place was filled with smoke. Makes it impossible to sing, by the way, when you have a room filled with smoke. And not only that, you know, was that terrible. There was nobody there this night. They did no promotions for the thing, whatever, fine. But in my career, the worst show I ever played was, I was in a sign band called 23 Rated Days. We were on an MTV Music Awards
tour. MTV Awards tour, yeah.
In 2009 with All Time Low. And we were on a side show in Missouri, some dumpy town in Missouri, probably Cedar Rapids. And I got way too involved with some girl before the show. I got completely drunk, like nearly blackout drunk. I don't remember playing, but I do remember when we stopped whatever we were doing that we were calling playing, the crowd was just looking at me like there was no applause. There was nothing. And then I think my keyboard player drove like 400 miles without saying a word to me. So that was a nightmare.
Sounds it. It sounds it. And when it comes to showtime, then what's your pre-show ritual and your post-show? How do you psych yourself up and then wind down afterwards? Are you like Stephen Piercy?
Nope. I mean, there's definitely one or two of us that is waiting for the bar in the venue to open so we can get something going on. But I mean, we just hang out in the green room, talk, tune, talk about what we're going to do on the stage, maybe make some changes on the set list. But there's no real space to really warm up. So the guitar guys are just kind of strumming, maybe changing strings. And then, you know, afterwards, right when we're off stage, we just go right over to the merch booth, honestly, for the rest of the show, and get to talk to people. And that's a lot of fun. And then we go out and eat. Some of us continue to drink. That's about right. Right, Ian? I mean,
I end up driving the car because I don't drink. So
Right. Interesting.
For reasons indicated in this broadcast.
And the other thing about playing at the Whiskey is that, you know, the Rainbow Room is a block away, and that's pretty much just as famous. So that's also a point, you know, a lot of the bands playing there, and even with us, like, we'll go there maybe to get something to eat before the show, but we typically will end our night there or at Mel's Diner right nearby. But, you know, pretty much every time we've played, I think we've closed the Rainbow down that night. It's weird that it's separated by a couple blocks because it's the same thing. I mean, same owner, same business. Everybody, you know, everybody that's at one place is either going to or coming from the other one, both sides. But that's pretty awesome, too. And, you know, you get the same vibes there as you do at the Whiskey of who's been there, who still goes there, and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I mean, we don't get too crazy before the shows. Yeah.
And if you've never been there, so the Whiskey a couple blocks up is the Rainbow, but right next to the Rainbow is the Roxy. So if you go the Roxy is like where Rat used to kind of have their home for all that time.
Hey, it's where Pee Wee Herman started. Did you know that, Ian?
I did not.
No, you didn't.
Pee Wee's Playhouse was a live show, was there. It was there for a year. And then that's when he got his movie deal based on that show at the Roxy. So yeah, it is. It's Whiskey, Roxy, Rainbow Room, all right there. I mean, that makes up the whole strip right there for me.
Yeah, and then two blocks south is the Troubadour.
One block south is the Viper Room.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all like right there. It's crazy. I mean, and it never gets old. It doesn't get old to me. We're getting ready to fly out there in June for our like 10th show there. And like, I'm still as excited as I was the first time.
So you're telling me if I ever make it to LA, then there's only one street I need to base myself on.
Well, I would go a few more blocks because there's a hotel at the end of it all. And then you could really do everything right there. But yeah, I mean, you know, that part of Hollywood right there, I mean, a quick, you know, Uber ride around there, you can hit like all the famous record stores and, you know, all of that stuff. It's all right there. And it's pretty awesome.
Just beware Airbnb listings that claim to be in Beverly Hills.
Yes. We did that. We're like, wow, an Airbnb in Beverly Hills? Holy shit, we'll take it. Wasn't in Beverly Hills, man.
Lovely.
It backed up to an alley behind some sketchy stuff. It's, yeah, yep, that's right.
Okay, I'll watch out for that. So before we dive into the last couple of questions, then, we've heard about the LP, we've heard some of the dates. Is there any other future plans you want to let us in on?
Right now, it's like we're in sort of the incubation phase of everything that's going to happen in 24. So we just started all of our booking, and I think we're looking toward picking up at least some legit tour with a signed act at some point toward the end of the year. But that's sort of like under wraps. We're not really ready to announce anything. And if you're following our pages, you'll be the first to hear about it.
Yeah. I think with this record, I mean, we're going to ride this record out. We really want to push it as far as we can. I mean, you know, we're not going to stop at one video. If we want to do some more, we'll just keep going with it. But knowing this guy right here, and I hope, by the way, this is laid out like it is now for everybody, this guy, I'm sure, you know, it's not even going to be September. And he's going to be like, I got an EP written. We got to get back in the studio. And I'm like, you know, but that's just how it goes. That's the beautiful thing about having such a great songwriter in the band, who's motivated, because, you know, he's always got something ready. The next thing is always laying there. But, you know, we really want to use this whole year for this record. I mean, you know, it comes out in May. We'll have a nice, you know, six full months to go ahead and ride it and push it. I mean, you know, like I said, some people look at albums and they just go away after they've listened to it a few times, and we're going to just try to push it as long as we can.
I like it. Right, we'll dive into the last couple. So a couple of random fun music questions. First off, what are you currently obsessed with? Now, it can be anything at all.
Jeff, are you obsessed with
anything? I've just gotten over being obsessed with We Are the World, the USA for Africa thing that happened, because they just put the documentary out on Netflix. And if you haven't seen it, it's one of the greatest things ever. I mean, watching video of Stevie Wonder teaching Bob Dylan how to sound like Bob Dylan is probably the best 15 minutes I've spent all year was watching that. It's great to watch. So I was really into that documentary. And of course, whenever I watch stuff like that, I go down rabbit holes and start looking up each and every version of everything. And I'm watching Hearing Aid Stars, and I'm watching, you know, Do They Know It's Good, and I'm getting into all that kind of stuff. Watching live videos from Live Aid, and you know, I just get into these watching holes. But yeah, I was very recently obsessed with USA for Africa.
Right.
And I had to find out how much funds were raised, how they actually used them. I was all fine. Dude, I was way in, man. I was all in. Now, keep it.
Well, I don't actually, you know, I really don't listen to a ton of music outside of the band's music. And certainly with the music we play, I hear a lot of it in, you know, when we're playing with other bands, I hear that stuff over and over again. I love that music, but I haven't listened to it in a long time, except we have a single that's coming out on the new record called 1987. So I have been like completely ensconced in everything that came out in 1987. In fact, I just got this in the mail, which is, you probably can't see it. It's a Circus magazine from 1987, which is a prop video. And so I'm just completely engrossed in everything that came out in 1987 at the moment.
Right. Weird fact, I was born in
1987. Hey, there we go. We got to celebrate you.
Yeah.
Are you like looking at, you're looking at what we got coming, like, why are they doing 1987? What's the deal with that?
Yeah. I was like, did they know? And if you could spend 24 hours locked in a room with any musician from history, who would it be?
I mean, it's going to either be Robert Smith or Nikki Sixx. I really don't want to be locked in a room with either of them, but I'd love to just pick their brain about songwriting over all that time. Probably Robert Smith. I'll go with Robert Smith. That seems like the more unlikely answer. But I was an obsessed Cure fan for most of my life. And I was sort of like the misfit that just definitely, I mean, it's like Jeff a lot, like where you drift from one style of music to the other and back again, you know, because in 87, I was listening to Poison and the Smiths in the same hour. You know what I mean? It wasn't like I was really differentiating. I mean, I fell more into the sort of metal side as a musician, but that's the music I love and grew up with. So probably Robert Smith, because he probably influenced more of my songwriting than anybody on the metal side for sure.
24 hours with anybody. Myself. I'll tell you why.
Oh, God.
I'm a school teacher. I'm around kids all day long. I got two kids of my own. I got all this and the dogs and everything. I would really love to have 24 hours by myself. And it has nothing to do with me wanting to be with myself. I just don't want to be with anybody else.
But he said from history. You're not really.
Oh, anybody from history? Well, I'm in history. I don't know. You know what? That's something I probably can't answer, because, and I'll tell you why. It's because you never know who you're really going to enjoy the time with. When I spent probably like over 2 hours in the green room talking with the drummer from Living Color, Will Calhoun, I mean, we just bonded. I mean, we talked for over 2 hours. I never would have thought he would be someone who I would get so much out of talking to. Like, I wouldn't just pick, oh yeah, dude, drummer from, Living Color. I would have loved to, you know, I'd like to hang out with Nikki Sixx and different people like that at some point, but 24 hours,
Yeah, I'm with you on the 24 hours.
24 Maybe. Hours is a long time, dude. Yeah.
30 minutes, I'm good.
Yeah, I actually really like that answer, though, about being by yourself for 24 hours. It's the first time anyone said it, but it would be heaven, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God. I mean, just hearing quiet at any point. Like, I mean, even my kids tell me, they're like, how come you're not listening to music in the car? You're Mr. Music. You're a music teacher. You're in a band. All you do in the record label. And I'm like, because I want silence. I don't want to listen to music. I get enough. I'm good. If I'm listening to the radio in the car a lot of times recently, it's silence or the news. until 15 minutes later and the kids break me down. And then, you know, I got to switch between Slipknot and Taylor Swift because I got a boy and a girl. So, and then I just want silence.
Right. And the final one. So what's your go-to album?
I mean, mine are the ones that everybody says, but there's a reason that they say it. Master of Puppets, I think, is the greatest album that's ever been made. Is Metallica in my top five bands? No. But that album is, if I want to go listen to a solid album, I know I can listen to that every time. That and probably Motley Crue's Shout at the Devil. It changed everything. I mean, I got them. I got their fit. That version of Motley Crue, most people, you know, they like to say Too Fast for Love. But, you know, it's Shout at the Devil all day for me. Beginning to end, I can listen to it a billion times.
Yeah, if I had to pick one record, it would be Disintegration by The Cure. And if I had a second on the way, it would be Too Fast for Love.
Great choices. Listen, guys, thanks a million now. It's been an absolute blast.
Absolutely, man.
And really appreciate it.
1987, that's awesome.
Yeah, I actually can't wait to hear that song now when it drops.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for having us on.
Appreciate it.
Against the wall, it's what you wanna be, but what you need is to be unbound. So I'll cut you down. I'm your forever, your dominator, and now you're begging me, please. It's time to let go. Black hearts and bloody bruises. Your world won't be. Day out, anytime at all. I'm in your head again. Looks like your collar was lost and found. Now you come around. I'm your forever, your captivator, and now you're begging me, please, taking it slow. Black hearts and bloody bruises. Your world.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please rate and review us on iTunes and Spotify. And if you're interested in signing up to Band Builder Academy, use the link in the show notes below and enter the code CONCERTS and you'll receive 10% off. So, until next time, keep rocking.
Hey, what are you guys still doing here? The show's over. It's over. You can go home. Go on. We'll see you next time. We'll be here. Bye.